So welcome to another edition of the Wellness Wednesdays podcast. We've got a special guest all the way from rainy British Columbia, an Olympian and someone you've probably heard talk about some of his exploits around the race walking world. Welcome to the podcast, Evan.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
And for those who don't know, Evan Dunphy is a race walking is one of the top race walkers in the world, and we can actually get started about and explain to me what is race walking for a lot of folks that don't know, and how come it's not as popular as it is in other parts of the country here in Canada.
Yeah, so very simply, race walking is differentiated from running by sort of two fundamental rules. So we have judges who are all around the course that watch us and make sure that we're following these two sort of key rules. The first rule that most people know is that we always have to have one foot in contact with the ground, and that's judged by the human eye. So a big problem we have is that, as you say, it's not the most popular thing in the world. So once every 4 years, we're put on TV at the Olympics, and all they do is show slow motion replays of both our feet off the ground. Which has been really unfortunate for us, but it's judged by the human eye. So, it has to be the decision from the judges that say, okay, that person has both feet off the ground. They give them a warning. The second rule is that your advancing leg has to be straight at the knee. So it's sort of why we have that bowed leg type of thing, straight leg, always the line of the straight leg. And that's sort of the only, the two things that differentiate from running.
And, from what I've seen, you folks are just as fit and You probably race walk a lot faster than most people run.
So we raced the 20 kilometer and 50 kilometer distances at the Olympics for the men. And the 20 kilometer the top guys are covering it in less than an hour 20. So that's sub 4 minute Ks, or sub 4 minutes per K, or 15 Ks an hour. And in the 50 K, we're covering it in about 4 minutes and 20 seconds per kilometer, which works out to be somewhere in the range of 13 and a half plus or minus kilometers an hour. So we're able to still move at a pretty high clip.
Yeah, and I've seen that you've raced all over the world, and you've done very well all over the world. How come there's none of these races in Canada? None of the high profile ones are in Canada.
Yeah, it's an event that has had some popularity in Canada in the past, big tradition of it in Quebec, pretty much until our current generation of top race walkers, who are all from BC, sort of all trained together here in BC. But before that, the big crop of guys through the 70s and 80s and 90s were from Quebec, guys like Marcel Jobin and Guillaume LeBlanc, who are still, from what I've been told, are still fairly well-known names in Quebec from people of that generation. Guillaume won a medal, silver medal in Barcelona in 1992. So there, we have had a bit of a tradition of it, but we just haven't had the success. And I think that's one of the things that in Mexico, it's huge because in the 60s and 70s, they were the best in the world at it. So when a country is successful at something, it tends to be more popular. And so we're hoping that with our current crop of guys all doing really well, that we can sort of, through our success, build up the grassroots and get more people interested and knowledgeable of the event and watch it grow a little bit.
That's awesome. So how does someone get started in race walking?
Yeah, so everyone's got different stories. But my story was basically I was 11 years old. I wanted to be really good at something. I was running. I loved running. And my older brother had also been running. He had his appendix taken out when he was 14, and his high school coach thought, okay, well, while your stitches heal, this race walking thing might allow you to maintain some of your fitness. So he tried that and was winning a few races because there's nobody that does it. And as the younger brother, I naively yet correctly assumed that if he could do it, it couldn't be very hard, and went and entered my first race and won that race. And from there, we're just like, okay, this is what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. And that was coming on 16 years ago now.
Yeah, and for someone who's watching at home, it looks different. What would you say is the toughest thing to do, or the toughest part of the technique for you or for the average race walker?
Yes, I think for myself, having started it at such a young age, I was able to get the hang of it quite quickly. But I coach high school kids and kids that are people that are further along in their sort of development. And the biggest thing I see is the shin. So that the muscle that basically lifts your toes up, it's called your tibialis anterior. And it is a muscle that you don't use very often, except in race walk, it becomes one of the predominant muscles because you land with a heel strike. So you're lifting your toes. And so, you know, I've seen university class cross country and track and field runners try to do 200 meters of race walking as a joke and make it 100 meters before they collapse on the infield, clutching their shins. It's just such a specialized group of muscles that you're using that it comes as quite a surprise to people that try it for the first time how sore they actually are in those muscles because they don't use it for anything else.
So do you have the the most developed shins in Canada, you think?
That's, I like to go to the gym and all the other guys are there flexing their biceps and all that stuff. And I just go in, just do some plantar flexion of the foot. And, you know, it hasn't worked as a method of hitting on girls yet, but give it time.
Yeah. And I'm sure all the Olympic stuff helps too. But yeah, no, it's not like the Arnold way of doing things from back in the day, but you never know.
Not yet.
No, give it some more time. So, do you know the story about how race walking came about?
I can give a rough synopsis. And luckily, if I screw it up, nobody's gonna know the difference. It started out as a very quintessentially British thing. It grew out of this thing called pedestrianism, which was basically before we had horse racing and before we had car racing, we used to have, especially in the U.S., it became quite big in the, early 19th century, of just people racing by foot to get the furthest. And it became a huge wagering syndicate, basically, a big betting syndicate. You'd have guys that would race for 6 days. So they'd start on Monday at midnight and they'd race till Saturday at 11:59 p.m. And because you weren't allowed to do any sport on Sunday. And it would basically be whoever could get the furthest in those 6 days was the winner. And they would do stuff. So Madison Square Garden back in the day, 100 yards or 120 yards around. And they would race 6 days, just going in circles, doing thousands and thousands of laps. And they'd draw huge crowds that would come and, bet on everything from which guy was going to collapse first to who was going to take the first meal break to all sorts of different things. And then horse racing came in and kind of it became pedestrian became obsolete and then car racing and et cetera, et cetera. So it kind of died out. But race walking was sort of born from that era.
And it's now, I mean, I guess running, the running races also have their ups and downs in terms of popularity. Like if a North American's doing well on the world stage, it gets a little more popular and then vice versa. I mean, most of the time we don't do as well as the Kenyans and some of the other African nations, but, who are the dominant, players other than Mexico in race walking?
Yeah. So the Chinese have definitely taken over as sort of the big powerhouse. They collected they collected a bunch of the medals in Rio on the men's and women's side. I've done races in China where we've had hundreds and hundreds of people in the race, followed by a mass participation race that would start after us that would have 10,000 people in it, of people just walking for fitness. So they're really pumping, they're using race walk to promote just general health and wellness, which I think is a brilliant idea because, walking as a concept is so accessible to so much of the population that, we could utilize that more, in racing and stuff like that. But, the Chinese are definitely dominant. The Russians have been the dominant force, but we've all we've all known why that was for many years, and now we've been confirmed that they've just all been on drugs the whole time. So it was nice in Rio to have the track and field events not be marred by having the Russians in there. It definitely made my two races much more fair and clean and enjoyable, really, from my perspective as well as people watching it.
Yeah, it's funny how the Russians seem to be doing that in a lot of sports, not just athletics. But now we know, and hopefully they'll clean up their act. And well, I guess we'll see in the next little while. Before we get into your Olympic journey, because it was pretty memorable for a lot of folks watching at home, so it'd be nice to get to your take on it. How are your hips? To me, again, obviously I've never raced walk, so I'm completely ignorant to this, but does that hurt? It seems like there's a lot of movement in the hips.
It's funny because the technique looks violent. It looks very aggressive.
It looks almost awkward.
Yeah, in reality, though, the impact is much less than running. So when you're running, you're putting, I think it's something like 5 to 7 times your body weight of force through your ankle every time you take a stride. And race walking is much lower. It's somewhere in the range of 2 to 2.5 or something like that times your body weight. So the impact that's actually going through your body is much lower because you have that, the having to keep one foot on the ground at all time. It's a lot more forward movement, whereas running is sort of a series of jumps, really, when you break down the running technique. So running leads to a lot more injuries at, overuse injuries, joint injuries, knee, hip issues, than race walking does. By way of example, you would never see a Olympic marathoner who is, you might occasionally see an Olympic marathoner in their early 40s if you're lucky. We had a guy in Rio in the 50K race walk who was 47 and still going strong. And I think that's a testament to that there's a lot more longevity in elite race walking careers. And I think that's living proof of the lower stress it takes on the body over time, despite it looking so much more aggressive and so much more brutal.
Yeah, I mean, when you see some of the world class runners, they look like they're basically like gliding along there, and then when you see some of the race walkers, it almost looks like a car crash every time they put their foot in front of the other. So, but good to know that you can have a long career. So you're still young, so you can. Who knows? I know a lot of the long distance athletes in the running world peak in their mid to late 30s. So you can, you've got a fairly bright career ahead. That's the plan, right? We need a medal from you so that we can, take the race walking to the next level. You can be the next.
That would certainly complete the story for sure.
Yeah. Speaking of your story in Rio. I remember I actually saw this. I didn't watch much of the Olympics, but I remember seeing this. You had a little bit of altercation or a bit of a bump in your 50K race with a fellow from Japan. And there was some back and forth. I guess he finished third, but then they ruled that he bumped you, and then the appeals came through. Can you give us a bit of behind the scenes of what happened, what you were going through, and how that kind of affected your psyche?
Absolutely, yeah. So it was the 50K race walk, and it was sort of my big event that I was on, that I was targeting. I'd raced the 20K a week earlier and had done really well, but the 50K was the event that I was aiming for. I knew if I had a perfect race, the medal was a possibility. It was by no means a guarantee, but it was a possibility. And so throughout the race, I raced with that attitude of staying near the front, fighting for that, to finish in that position. And at 40K, the group had kind of dwindled down to 4 of us. I had taken the lead. I had tried to walk off the front to no avail. And at 40K, 3 of the guys came flying past me, leaving me in 4th place. I sort of spent 4 or 5K feeling sorry for myself in 4th place. The other guys looked good. I wasn't going to catch them. I was kind of down on myself. And at 45K, I convinced myself, no, what are you doing? Just go try to catch those guys. Put your head down. Just empty the tank. See how far it gets you and see what happens. So I was about 20 seconds down on Hiroki, the Japanese athlete in third place at the time. And so over the next 4K, I slowly cut down that gap to where at 49 kilometers into the race, so we're over 3.5 hours in, there's less than 5 minutes to go, and I pulled up beside him, and the two of us were now in a battle for third place. I had gone to pass him. He responded, tried to pass me back. Neither of us was physically capable of walking in a straight line at this point because we were just both on fumes, basically trying to get to the finish line. And we ended up bumping into each other. And it completely threw me off my stride. Threw me off my stride because of the physical altercation, more of the mental, just my brain couldn't process what was happening. And once that happened, everything else sort of shut down more or less. But long story short, he went on to finish third. I came across the finish line in fourth. About an hour later, they disqualified him and I was elevated to third, which, winning an Olympic medal had been sort of a dream of mine since I was 10 years old. In that moment, nothing felt right. I had this pit in my stomach telling me that this was wrong. That this wasn't, this isn't how I wanted to win a medal, and all that stuff. And so luckily, about 3 hours later, so after 3 hours of being the bronze medalist, Hiroki's appeal was successful and I was back in the fourth place, at which point we were given the opportunity to appeal once more to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. And I basically just told the Canadian Olympic Committee, no, I'm happy with fourth, let's end it there. And then I found out afterwards that a lot of people back home were following the story, which I didn't realize.
Yeah, I mean, for a day or two, race walking was a big deal in Canada. So it's
it was fantastic.
You must have got lots of love from people, and especially like your story kind of appealed to a lot of people because the fact that you didn't appeal, your brand and the fact that you came out the nice guy in this, and kudos for, because I know it must have been a roller coaster of emotions. I mean, you just put it all out on the field. Must have been a very warm day too. So probably completely drained physically, probably completely drained mentally as well. And can you give us a little bit of the, like, what's going through your mind at that time? Like those 6 hours must have been like, wow, like that's a roller coaster of a lifetime.
Yeah, it was crazy because so I came across the finish line, collapsed to the ground. It had been a really hot day, and despite that, I'd set a personal best by over 2 minutes and broken the national record again. And so I'd really left it all on the table. It was the first time I'd ever finished a race and felt like, okay, I had 50,000 meters in me. I didn't have 50,001. I had nothing to be ashamed of in that race. I knew I had given it everything I had. So I was immediately quite content with fourth place. I also at that point hadn't really remembered that 4.5 minutes ago we had collided with one another. That's sort of the mental state that I was in, that I couldn't really remember that happening. I was taken to the medical tent. I was told not to go speak to the media for a little while, that I probably wasn't in the most coherent of states. So I sat in the medical tent for a while, recovering a little bit, and went and did all the media zone stuff, all that, mandatory talk to people thing. And shortly after that, it was announced that I was bronze medalist. And as I said, I immediately didn't feel good about that. And I went from there, from that moment, I went to the drug testing room where Hiroki, the Japanese athlete, was, and he came to me and through a translator apologized for what had happened and very sincere and very this is a point where he had been disqualified, so he was coming to me at a point where he had already been disqualified and he was apologizing for what he did. And that to me made, when it came time to make the decision, it was quite easy to make that decision, knowing it was the right one to do. And Since that happened, like Hiroki and I have become really good friends. And although we don't speak each other's language, the beauty of the age we live in is that Facebook automatically translates everything he posts on Facebook for me. So I'm able to sort of keep up to his career. And so, you know, it's a really cool thing that's happened since then. The other thing I was going to say was that I called my sports psych the next day or emailed my sports psych the next day and said, you know, we had rehearsed how I was going to deal with every situation. We had rehearsed winning the race. We had rehearsed coming second, third, fourth, last, getting disqualified, not finishing. Emailed her saying, you know, we prepared for absolutely every scenario, but we did not prepare for this. And, you know, as you said, I think more than anything, it was a mentally exhausting day. But, you know, I haven't once since that day regretted the decision or thought about, you know, what if I had appealed. So it made it a pretty, you know, I know I made the right decision, which is awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it in retrospect, but it's one of those things that all you have to do is appeal and you might have gotten an Olympic medal. You know, like it obviously sounds like you made the right decision, especially for yourself, but there's a lot of people at home who are like, well, he could have had an Olympic medal. So no, but again, to me, it all comes out in the wash. And, this will, you know, obviously that bond with, the Japanese athlete, is a great thing. And you're still young in your career. You've still got a lot ahead of you, but, there's a lot of people, I think, there were like, it's one of those things that you had the race of your life and it could have led to Olympic medal. So kudos on you for taking the higher road.
Yeah. And I mean, the only thing I'd add to that is that, you know, if I had gotten the medal and finished, you know, been one of however many bronze medals we did end up winning in Rio, I probably wouldn't be on the podcast talking to you today. You know what I mean? Like, that's one of the things that people say, oh, like, you know, you could have had the medal. It could have been done wonders for your career, but in a selfish, looking at it from a very selfish perspective, not getting the medal has done so much more for my career than having the medal would have done. And if you frame it that way as well. So really at the end of the day, no matter how you look at the situation, I've sort of come out positively from it, which is awesome when that works out that way.
It's funny. Most of the time when you make the right decision, it might not be the best at the time, but it usually works out for you in the long run. So that's great. That's a great little experience. And now I want to talk a bit more about some nutrition stuff. You're also known now as one of the poster boys for the high fat, low carb. I don't want you to call it, I don't know if it's trend or whatnot, but, can you tell me a bit more about what happened and how you kind of got into this path?
Yeah. So over the last, 2 years, 2 winters, I've headed down to Australia to take part in some research studies through the Australian Institute or at the Australian Institute of Sport, funded by the Australian Catholic University, through Louise Burke, she is in my mind the top sports nutritionist in the world, just an absolutely brilliant mind, and she loves race walkers. She loves working with us, which is much to our benefit. So the last 2 years, she's organized these just unbelievably intense studies to look at the effects of high-fat diets on elite athletes, because we live in a world where there is so much anecdote around this topic, but no actual evidence. There's not been any proper studies done. And so she basically just wanted to set out and get some actual hard evidence. So last year we had, I think, 28 odd athletes come through over two camps, participate either in a high fat diet, a normal high carb diet, or what we call a periodized diet, where you spend most of your time on a high carb diet with the occasional workout being carb depleted or not having replenished your carbs after the previous workout. And sort of we did that for 3.5 weeks. We did some testing before, we did some testing after, and we looked at how the diet changed those things. And so this, in December, the results of that study were published, and the results basically said that the high fat diet is not an effective tool for improving performance in highly trained elite athletes. And people immediately just Twitter went crazy with people saying, oh, this study's stupid. This study, you did, you know, people that probably didn't even read the study, because people are, diets are one of those things. I think, you know, diets are up there with politics and religion, where people are going, people have their side and nothing is going to sway them from their side. Which has been fascinating to be a part of that world, because I've gotten to see that firsthand and been, just, it's so interesting. But, long story short, I've done two stints on a high fat diet, which basically means that for 3.5 weeks, I received less than 40 grams a day of carbs. So 80% of my nutrition is coming from fat, 15% of it's coming from protein, and about 5% of it's coming from carbs. And we do that. Every single calorie was prepared for us and counted and recorded and monitored for those 3.5 weeks. And we had about 400 finger prick blood tests to monitor glucose and ketones and lactate during all these different workouts. And just the amount of manpower that had to go into a study like this is just immense. And we've now pulled off two of these studies to try to really bring the research together and just found some fascinating stuff.
Yeah, so I'm a big proponent of some high fat stuff, especially for some low, you know, some lower level cardio stuff. Obviously, I'm not on your level, is what I'm trying to say. Like, I do a lot of fat fasted rides, where I'm just kind of puttering around, or just riding through, you know, the country roads around here. And I find the high fat makes me feel incredible and I get enough energy, but I'm also not trying to set a world record in a 50K race walk. So it's totally different. So, and I think most people.
I'll just say that, and I think that's a huge fundamental, point there, is that, you know, to get a little bit sciencey for just a second. So basically what we ended up finding out, which we kind of already knew, was that the level of even a 50K race walk, which sounds like it would be fairly low intensity, is still being done at such a high percentage of your VO2 max, you know, the max amount of oxygen you can use to create energy aerobically. We're still over 3.5-4 hours still operating about 80% of our VO2 max. And basically what we found is that no matter how well adapted you get to burning fats, and we did get more adapted. So over 3.5 weeks, we improved our ability to burn fat. But it still wasn't improved enough to provide us with the energy quick enough that carbs do. And so when you get into a more recreational sense of athletes, or, you know, recreational athletes that are just trying to run a marathon or do an Ironman, or, you know, just whose end goal is sort of completion, they're going to be operating at 60% of their VO2 max, probably a little bit less. And in that case, being fat adapted, being better at burning fat is brilliant, because you have so much, you know, you have tens of thousands of calories worth of fat stores. You know, even me at 10% body fat has tens of thousands of calories available to burn, whereas you only have a couple hours of carbs. So for an athlete that doesn't, whose energy requirements are a bit lower and don't necessarily need their energy as quickly as elite athletes, a high fat diet makes perfect sense. But I think those lines have been blurred in popular science, you know, popular science or Twitter science, as I like to call it, where that distinction isn't being made. And I think that's a huge fundamental issue.
Yeah, and also a lot of people that are, I mean, the folks I think that would really benefit from the high fat diet are the folks that are sitting at home doing nothing. You know, like, they're just in their everyday life, they'll walk to work or walk from the car to their office. I think obviously you're not going to get into anaerobic state that way. So I think those are the ones But then they look at this study like, oh no, I'm going to go back to eating my carbs because I need all that energy. And you're like, well, what do you need the energy for? I mean, I can tell from my own.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, and obviously I'm not part of a scientific study, but I can tell from my own stuff. Like if I have to play 2 hockey games in a night, if I don't eat carbs in between, I find my second game is I don't have the same energy. And again, and obviously that's a little bit of, you know, some more intense kind of cardio, but it's not a full study, but I can usually tell a little bit, where I'm kind of lacking that energy. But yeah, I can, some of the stuff that you're doing is, yeah, especially if you're training for some high, some high intensity stuff or a lot of miles. I mean, you'll need some carbs, once in a while. It's just, but you're right. Like the clickbait and that kind of stuff. And I love people that have, you know, Twitter debates. It's like, you really don't want to debate. If you really want to debate, you wouldn't be on Twitter. You know, Twitter's are not really the best place.
Yeah.
not the really the best of the venue for debate. But yeah, they see the headline. They're like, oh yeah, let's throw out the baby, the bathwater. So what are your thoughts on?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So what's your day to day diet these days?
So I'm back on primarily a high carb diet. So this second study we did this year in Australia, the thing we were looking at, the difference between the study from last year was, last year, a lot of us came off the diet, went back on the carbs and then raced really well 10 days later. And so we're like, oh, you know, maybe there's something here. We didn't have any scientific data to back this up. But we just had a bunch of anecdotes that suggested that maybe if you become fat adapted and then you go back on carbs and then you race, you can maybe get the best of both worlds. You can maybe utilize fat a little bit better, but then still have the benefit of having carbs. And so this time around, the difference was after we came off the high fat diet, we went back onto a carbohydrate diet that was still monitored for another 10 days. And then we had our big race. So they still had data to collect from to look objectively at the race results. And, you know, I can't, they'd have to do all the stats and look at it scientifically to say if it worked or not. But, that was sort of the idea that we were looking at, is say, okay, well, let's treat this like altitude. You know, you go to altitude to get better at sea level. So why can't you go on a high fat diet to maybe improve your peak performance when you're on carbs? So that's what we've sort of been looking at this time around. I think it makes perfect sense. I think it's been quite a fascinating, it could be quite game changing in how athletes periodize. You know, we periodize so much. We periodize our training, we periodize, you know, all these different aspects of being an athlete. Why wouldn't we periodize our food? Waiting to see the results of that study were, but I think that's the only thing that could convince me to go back onto a high fat diet. Otherwise I'm happy being on my 60 to 70% carbs every day, all day going forward in life until I retire.
I was going to say, what after you retire, what are you going to do?
Oh, I don't want to have to think about that for, I'm sure there'll be a hundred new fads that will come out that will say they're the best between now and then. So I'll pick whatever fad is most current at the time.
And when is the result from this study going to come out?
So amazingly, they were able to collect all that data last year and publish a study by December. If they're able to do that again, then we look at, you know, somewhere towards the end of the year. But you know, that's an amazing turnaround for a study of that size to be able to push the data out that quickly. So, you know, you're looking at the end of the year, early next year, hopefully, to really have the firm results from that public. So, exciting times ahead for sure.
I'm looking forward to the study and the Twitter debates that will ensue from this. So it should be more. And it's funny because most people just back up their argument with whatever couple of lines that are coming out in the study. They'll just pick and choose their evidence. So it's always part of the fun. Evan.
Yeah, I think the best tweet I've seen was someone suggested that 3.5 weeks wasn't long enough to adapt. And so someone replied to that saying, you know, the high fat dieters will always say that the optimal time to adapt is 1 week longer than the study lasted. And I thought that really summed up the crux of you know, that type of debate, where it was nothing was ever going to be good enough for either side to move an inch.
Well, Evan, I know you're a busy guy. You're back to race walking around town and do some of the other great stuff that you're doing. But before I go, two more things. One, this is a wellness podcast, and obviously you're a living example of this. But what does wellness mean to you?
I think it's balance. It's, you know, my job is to go out and walk 30 to 40 kilometers a day, which, you know, isn't the most balanced lifestyle. But I think for the every average person in wellness is just finding it a little bit healthier. You know, you don't have to make radishes, change a little bit, get a little bit more exercise. You know, just as long as you're moving in the right direction and you're happy, then I think you're achieving wellness.
Very good. And one last question. This is going to be an easy one for you. Where can people find more, can find out more about you, follow your journey and cheer you on?
Yeah. So right now, as I try to rebuild my website, social media is the best way to follow me. And, all of those things, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, are just at Evan Dunphy. Yeah, very, very easy to find. No underscores, no letters, no nothing like that.
Just no numbers. Right. So
clear and simple.
Very good. I'll link to all your accounts in the show notes. And again, I want to really thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to chat and share your story. Some really cool stuff. And we'll be keeping tabs on you and making sure that you're still making us proud. And again, thank you so much for the opportunity.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
And once again, you've been listening to Wellness Wednesdays. I am your host, Eric Collard. Until next week, be well.